From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
That first screening was a theater full of mass sobbing, and I didn't expect it. I really didn't expect it. But there's something, it's not sad, it's cathartic.
No, it's not sad, yes.
That's really what it is. It's a different kind of emotion.
Director Morgan Neville anticipated that his new documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, about the life and legacy of Fred Rogers, might elicit some emotion. He was not prepared to be confronted with a river of tears wherever it played. Neville tells us how he convinced Fred Rogers' family and estate to participate in this film and then got fully funded before shooting a frame. But first on the News Banter, a big ruling on the AT&T acquisition of Time Warner is on the horizon. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my co-conspirator and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So June 12th, we are expecting a big, big court decision that could really go a long way towards an already underway remaking of the Hollywood landscape. And this would go to AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner, which is HBO and Warner Brothers and CNN, notably, which is why some people thought the Justice Department tried to block this acquisition. They said it was an antitrust violation, but the feeling was that Trump had made clear his dislike for CNN. So all of that is now potentially going to be acquired by AT&T. And as I said, there were some who thought this was a politically motivated case brought by the Justice Department. Whether it was or not, people who were handicapping the trial as it went on were leaning towards a decision favoring the acquisition, AT&T. And if that happens, it will be like a gun goes off, you know, at the start of the race in Hollywood. It already kind of has gone off. We know that Disney is trying to buy Fox. We know that Comcast is waiting in the wings, potentially to make another better offer for Fox, potentially better. We know that there's already CBS and Viacom have this fight going on over merging or not merging. So there is a scramble underway, and it will only be dramatically accelerated if the judge rules as people anticipate.
Yeah, pick your metaphor here. I mean, shoe to drop or fuel to the fire or starter gun. This is going to be the beginning of a wave of consolidation. And what is scaring everyone in Hollywood, as we know, is the power of these digital giants, whether it's Apple or Facebook or Google or Netflix. I mean, the fact that these companies are getting into the content space and they're able to do things that traditional Hollywood companies are not able to do, whether it's sell advertising across an integrated platform or pay someone like Ryan Murphy $300 million to leave Fox and come over to Netflix. Netflix is becoming so dominant in the content space that these companies that are traditional studios feel they need to bulk up. And if this AT&T deal is allowed to go through, we're going to see a wave of these deals.
Yeah, I mean, Comcast would certainly argue and does argue when it sells advertising every year that it does provide multi-platform advertising opportunity. They all argue that if they can. But certainly the success of Netflix in the streaming space has been terrifying. And as we've talked about in the past, the studios have gotten rich selling their old TV shows, and it's a very rich pipeline of money that they have enjoyed having. But at the same time, it's allowed Netflix to become this giant thing. I have questions. Like, for example, Netflix just is a geyser of money. There are announcements pretty much every day of one or more new shows. Nobody can possibly keep track of how that goes. And you do have to wonder, how long can that continue? And they've started to dial back somewhat. You know, now they're canceling some things where they've really taken a big bath, but it is still remarkable. And, you know, meanwhile, in comes Apple or Google or whoever. Breaking in the way Netflix did is not an easy feat to replicate unless you acquire a studio. I think that the reason these studios have been, you know, such a tight little club is because figuring out how to get this done is so hard. No one has really been able to launch a successful standalone big studio in many, many years, and people have tried.
No, and James Murdoch of Fox said it almost exactly that when he was asked last week about Apple getting into the content business. And he essentially said, yeah, they can do some shows, but to actually have a library of content that is meaningful takes years and billions of dollars, and he wondered whether they are in it for the long haul or whether they would just buy their way in. Netflix is spending $8 billion a year, not on licensing, they are doing that still as well, but their focus is original content, and they're doing that because they know that they are going to have to compete with these studios that are going to take their content back, and Disney is going to launch a competitive service to try to put Netflix out of business.
Or more than one, yeah.
Or more than one. And Disney has this full library of content that they can throw at Netflix, so they want their own. And it remains to be seen whether the Netflix model, which has been supported entirely by the stock price going up and up and up because the subscriber numbers have been going up and up and up, that's going to soften at some point. And the question is, when that happens and the stock softens, is Netflix going to be able to continue to spend what they're spending?
Yes, in the more immediate term, you know, people are going to wonder if AT&T takes over Warner Brothers, Time Warner, how much will the guards change, you know, at the various units there? If Disney buys Fox, who survives and gets a big job at Disney? Who's left out in the cold? So there's this anxiety just permeating the town right now because, you know, you might say, well, I'm not sure what's going to happen at my company, so I should look for a new job. But where do you look with everything so much in flux? I'll tell you one person who's not worried about that, Matt. Greg Berlanti.
Yeah, Greg Berlanti, who's one of the most prolific TV creators working today, he just re-upped his deal at Warner Brothers for, depending on who you believe, we reported $400 million. Others are saying $300 plus, which is sort of a vague term. Regardless, it is a gigantic deal. And what's interesting about it is that one of the first TV creators of the Netflix era to thumb his nose at Netflix and stay with his home studio, Warner Brothers, but for an astronomical price. It just shows what the arms race is like right now for these top creators.
Yes, while the execs are sweating it, these creators are getting really rich, and Berlanti just had so much business at the CW, so that's his natural home at Warner Brothers. He has shows like The Arrow, Flash, Riverdale, Supergirl. He really knows how to make those things and make them work well enough. 14 shows.
Right. And the irony here, of course, is that many of those shows are also on Netflix.
Yes, once they've aired on elsewhere, yeah.
So even though he re-upped his deal at Warner's, a lot of that money is coming from Netflix.
Yeah, I'm sure Netflix likes him a lot, too. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine?
50 years ago, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood debuted nationally on public television. Even if you didn't grow up with the show, you probably know that every episode began with the same ritual. Mr. Rogers would come in through his front door, take off his jacket, and put on a colorful cardigan. Then he'd remove his dress shoes in favor of blue sneakers. All the while, he'd sing the show's theme song, which ends with a question.
Please won't you be my neighbor?
Won't You Be My Neighbor is also the title of a new documentary that explores the legacy of Fred Rogers, the consummate host of a show that was made for children but had plenty to teach people of all ages. The film features interviews with Rogers' widow and children, as well as the show's cast and crew. Producer Margie Whitmer explains how, in many ways, the show was a fluke.
We had a director that once said to me, if you take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite, you have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Low production values, simple set, unlikely star.
Won't You Be My Neighbor was directed by our guest today, Morgan Neville. Neville's been producing and directing documentaries for the better part of 20 years. He won an Oscar for 20 Feet from Stardom, his 2013 film about backup singers. The reaction to his newest project caught him off guard. So your film, Unlikely But True, is an incredible tearjerker.
Honestly, I didn't realize it until we were just about done with the movie. I mean, I knew it was emotional material and it struck me very emotionally. But when we were finally finishing the mix and watching it back, I started crying. And I had lived with this film for a year and a half. And I thought that was just an aberration.
You were like, I may have stayed up too late.
Yeah, maybe it was that. But then when we premiered it at Sundance, that first screening was a theater full of mass sobbing. And I didn't expect it. I really didn't expect it. But there's something, it's not sad, it's cathartic.
No, it's not sad, yes.
That's really what it is. It's a different kind of emotion.
I mean, it's sad in a way because Mr. Rogers, at this point in life where we are in such a terrible state in this country of division, the openness, the accepting quality that he had, that is something I think people long for and always long for, even regardless of whoever's in the White House, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I started this film a couple of years ago, and the basic trend we've had in our culture for a long time towards incivility and divisiveness was the thing I was reacting to. And really, the thing that made me want to start the film was staying up too late one night on YouTube watching Fred Rogers' speeches.
Why would you do – why?
Well, they're
great. Not
that
it's a terrible thing to do, but
and,
like –
I mean, there are a lot of things that happened before. He kept popping up. I'd made a film with Yo-Yo Ma years ago.
Yes.
And Yo-Yo would talk about Fred Rogers and tell me things about him that were very surprising and kind of profound. And I just – somehow I found myself going down the rabbit hole. And I just felt like this was a voice I don't hear in our culture anywhere. This adult, grown-up voice that's empathetic and looking out for our long-term health, really, as a culture. And I just felt like I wanted to spend more time exploring that. I mean, because his message really – I mean, he talks about the neighborhood and being a good neighbor, but he's really talking about the fundamental issues of how we live together in a society and what kind of citizens we're going to be. What's our responsibility to each other? I mean, it's the most basic stuff, and it's the stuff that people take for granted. And what you realize is you have to nurture those things. You can't take them for granted. I mean, Fred was trying to teach kids, but really, I think now hopefully remind adults of the importance of having a good neighborhood and being neighborly, you know, being considerate of each other.
He was a minister.
He was a minister. And it's interesting because, you know, he was Presbyterian, but he studied all the world's religions. I mean, he was a deeply curious person. He learned Hebrew. He learned Greek. He studied Judaism, Buddhism, and Islam. And so he, I think, came up with kind of a global humanist point of view of what are the common humanist qualities in all the world's religions, and how do I impart that basic humanity to children who don't yet know how to be people? That feels like a lesson that a lot of people need to be learning these days.
So you're sitting there and you're watching this on YouTube.
Yeah.
Was there a voice in your head saying, everybody's going to look at you like you're out of your mind if you tell them you want to make a documentary about Mr. Rogers?
Yeah. In fact, I really had a little insecurity about that in the beginning. So to finish the story, I stay up late watching these speeches on YouTube. I wake up in the morning and I turn to my wife and I say, what do you think about the idea of a Mr. Rogers documentary? I will say my wife is a children's librarian. So she was a little biased because she said, that sounds amazing. And then I went into my office and I talked to my producer about it. And they liked the idea. And then I called Nicholas Ma, who's Yo-Yo's son, who's a friend of mine. And I floated it by him. And he said, I love that idea and I want to help you make it. So Nicholas is my other producer on the film. And he took me down to Pittsburgh to meet the Rogers family and the estate and everybody else, which was the next part of trying to get the film made, which is getting an estate and a family who's been very protective
for
decades.
Nobody had done
Had ever done anything like this. And I went in saying, I want to do this film. But I told them they couldn't have any control too. So they had to trust me enough to do that. They thought about it and they were – once they decided to trust me, it was huge. I mean, they opened up their arms and it was – kind of everything I could have needed, I had.
You got access to some insane amount of material, right?
Yeah, incredible material. But what I think they responded to in my pitch to them was I said, I don't want to make a biography of Fred Rogers. I want to make a film about the ideas of Fred Rogers. And Joanne, Mrs. Rogers, who's wonderful, said to me, well, that sounds like a good idea because Fred always said if anybody made a film out of his life, it'd be the most boring film of all time. Which I don't agree with, but I think they responded to the idea because one thing Fred struggled with in his own life was being taken seriously. I mean, he did a show that was simple and deep, but a lot of times people mistake simple for superficial. And what he was doing was so profound and so deep and so much thought went into everything that I don't think he ever got credit for what it was he was doing.
And he went into things very difficult. You know, I was, I guess, not of an age to watch that when Robert Kennedy was shot. But he took that on in 1968 with an explanation of how, what is this, an assassination for little kids, which absolutely remarkable for a show to try to do that.
What does assassination mean?
Have you heard that word a lot today?
Yes. And I didn't know what it meant.
Well, it means somebody getting killed in a sort of surprise way.
David Bianculli, who we interview in the documentary, who's a TV critic,
yeah,
said he thinks it's the greatest moment of television history was that assassination special.
And it's not one-off. He did other equally difficult things.
He did them in the wake of any number of tragedies, from the Challenger to the Gulf War to...
Oh, yes. The Challenger is such a sad moment of the film. It's just incredible how it brings it back so much.
But what you realize is he's making a show for 2 to 6-year-olds, essentially, and he's dealing with issues all the time, like death and bullying and divorce.
Did you ever know any grown-ups who got married and then later they got a divorce? Well, it is something that people can talk about, and it's something important.
Yeah, he took it very seriously.
Because I think really what he felt his calling was to help children understand the world. And I think he talked a lot about fear, fear being kind of the great force that pushes in the opposite direction of where we want to go. If love is the direction that we want to go, then fear is the opposite of love.
I mean, if only that were relevant today, right? So when you go, when you're doing your interviews, you do get access to people who have never talked about this publicly before.
Yeah, his sons had never talked before.
And some of the people who worked on the show.
Yeah.
There was one guy.
I bet it was Nikki Tallow, right? The stage manager?
Probably. Yeah. You know what I'm about to
ask.
He's
a little salty.
But he implies at one point that there are crazy stories that he's not going to tell. And I felt like, well, of course, that's where my little radar is like, really? Yeah. What are they? Tell me now.
Well, I think it was more in the 70s. There were a bunch of hippies working on the show who smoked a lot of pot and drank a lot and were crazy. And not that Fred partook in any of this, but that it was happening there on the set. And I think there was something about Fred who actually enjoyed those people being around. He wasn't prude at all. In fact, he was kind of the opposite of it. So even though he himself would never swear, the biggest swear word he would typically use would be mercy. That's what he would say if something bad happened. But when somebody would tell an off-color, you know, a dirty joke, say, he would laugh. And if somebody else came in, he couldn't repeat the joke. He would say, tell him what you told me. Tell him. You know, and Johnny Costa, who was the famous piano player that played on the show for decades, who was a very good friend of Fred's, was a very salty jazz musician.
Yes, and he was quite a character.
So I think Fred liked those people. He liked that because it wasn't what he was. He was a rich kid who grew up isolated, you know, in a mansion in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. So he got a chance to hang out with the other kids.
There are many ways.
Coming up after a short break, Morgan Neville tells us how KCRW's very own Matt Holzman played a role in the making of Won't You Be My Neighbor. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Morgan Neville, director of the new documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor? The film is in theaters now. Won't You Be My Neighbor offers an intimate look at the children's TV show that became an unlikely phenomenon, and at Fred Rogers, who believed deeply that what children saw on television mattered.
Love is at the root of everything. All learning, all parenting, all relationships. Love or the lack of it. And what we see and hear on the screen is part of who we become.
When Neville got the cooperation of Fred Rogers' family and estate in Pittsburgh, he got access to the show's rich archives. But at that point, he still needed money to make the film. What happens then?
Then, actually, the next thing that happened was a dinner at Matt Holtzman's house.
Wait a minute. Our KCRW's very own Matt Holtzman, by the way, invented this show.
So Matt had a dinner party, and I sat next to a friend of both of ours, Caroline Labresco from Sundance, who runs this new program called Catalyst, where they bring in people that want to fund independent movies. So they then curate a small group of documentaries and a small group of scripted features. And you come in and you make a presentation to these people, and they're foundations, individuals, equity investors, but people that want to fund independent film. And then you spend the next 2 days meeting people that liked your ideas. And it was like getting the golden ticket to Willy Wonka's factory. It was kind of unbelievable. But we went in, we made our pitch, and
they cried.
I heard tears at the end of the pitch, and I thought, okay, this is a good thing.
Yeah. Everybody cries, and they're like, here's the money. Is it like that simple? Yeah,
kind of.
A little spooky.
Yeah.
How long is the presentation to this group?
15 minutes. We hadn't started the film.
Exactly.
And in fact, most of the films at Catalyst had already started. Certainly all the documentaries had already started
production and could
really show teaser trailers or scenes and were much more complete. We were probably the least complete project there. But I think we had a pretty clear vision of what we wanted to do with the film, and something about it clicked. It's been happening on this film from the beginning, but
karma.
We walked away after a couple of days with
Kismet.
All of our funding, which was amazing. And we realized that we had to make it quickly.
And that was because?
That was because a couple of things. I hadn't realized that the 50th anniversary was actually this year. It just didn't occur to me.
Yes.
And it just also felt even more like it was just the voice I want to get back into the culture.
This is a Trump illusion or a election illusion?
Yeah, but everything. I just feel like there's nobody advocating for kindness in our culture.
Right.
We tend to dismiss it as naive. And I feel like what's so great about Fred Rogers is here's a lifelong Republican minister.
Which is something that I have to admit I did not expect to hear, that he was a Republican for his whole life.
Yeah. I think he was a cultural Republican, you know, coming from where he came from in Western Pennsylvania and coming from a very affluent family in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. But I think if you look at him, as I said, I mean, he's talking about a kind of common set of beliefs that I think should supersede any kind of political divide. And essentially, he's talking to kids who have no sense of division or tribalism or anything. I think that was fundamentally his belief, that he could do more. Yeah.
And that this was a moment where we needed to hear that voice.
Absolutely.
So when you do get your funding at the this Catalyst program, do you then go to the film festival, the Sundance Film Festival, as a matter of course, or is it just go back and apply to the thing like everybody else?
No, it was not. There was nothing guaranteed about the film getting into Sundance. They're very clear about that. And I've had a lot of success with Sundance and appreciate it, but I did not count on it. But I felt like Sundance was the best launching pad for the film because it was the beginning of the year. It was going to be this kind of 50th anniversary year. I wanted the film to come out throughout the entire year. And we were lucky enough to get in and premiere there, and people reacted from the first screening so strongly that it's kind of taken on a life of its own.
So where does Focus Features pick it up?
So we sold it to them maybe 8 months before Sundance.
My goodness.
Yeah. And I guess I'll admit this, but we sold it to Focus without showing them a frame.
Okay. That's a leap of faith.
Yeah, it was. And we pitched it to a number of different distributors and said, here's the subject and here's the filmmaker. And a number of people were interested, but Focus was particularly interested and got it and were excited about it. And part of why we did that was that I've been in situations where you're selling a film at 4 a.m. at Sundance.
Yes, and, good times, right?
Yeah. And the thing is, you're meeting somebody in the middle of the night who's going to be your partner for the next year releasing your film. And I just didn't want to be in a situation where I didn't know how the whole year was going to play out. And PBS is one of our partners on the film, and we wanted them to be part of it, which complicates it. So we actually went into Sundance with a plan. Like, we knew roughly when we were going to release the film, and it helped tremendously.
And you had this buyer in place.
Yeah.
When you're in the Catalyst Institute and then Focus Features comes along and says, like, I'll buy this. Haven't seen it. Sounds great. the money go back to the investors, or how does that part work?
Well, what we did, which I'm actually very happy with how it worked out, is that what we did at Catalyst is we told everybody we wanted to split our film's financing half philanthropic, half equity.
Uh-huh.
And so we capped our equity.
The logic was what?
The logic was that it gave us more freedom to basically take a lesser offer to accommodate the PBS window, and that
the PBS window is are they showing it?
They have a free broadcast window in the future, but a lot of big distributors typically won't touch any film that isn't 100% available.
They want to sell the broadcast.
They want to sell the broadcast rights.
So this one was already sold.
This was sold or promised to PBS. Actually,
yeah.
We didn't even sell it to them. We just said PBS has to have a window on this because it felt like the right thing to do for the subject and for the film. So it gave us the freedom to be responsible to those who did invest their equity. And it worked. You know, it was very easy to fill up our equity side.
I was going to say, did you have to turn people away and say,
yes,
I'm sorry, we have all the money we need. Go. Thank you.
We turned many people away.
Many?
Yeah.
I'm a little like, really? Yeah. You know? I mean, yes, Mr. Rogers was an icon and of childhood memory for a lot of people, but it just feels extraordinary. Right? Were you surprised?
I was, you know, like I said, I didn't know what to expect from this all. And, you know, part of it is I've been a career filmmaker and documentary filmmaker, and I have a pretty good track record. And I think it was really people trusting me and trusting that I was going to execute the vision that I was talking about, which was really something that was deeper than a biodoc. In fact, I don't think of the film as a biodoc at all, and I don't think of it as an exercise in nostalgia. To me, it's a profound statement. It was kind of the statement I wanted to hear and kind of wanted to make too.
So, a plea for kindness.
Yeah. I mean, Fred often talked about the term grace. I say radical kindness is how I think of Fred's works, but I think he would have called it grace. That was the idea that he thought societies thrived on, which is essentially when we treat others well, whether or not they deserve it, and we passed along as much as we can.
Well, how important was it to you to have a theatrical release?
I think it was very important. And part of it is, and I will say, you know, having made documentaries for a long time, certain documentaries play fine on television. There's something about this film, if you see it in a theater with people, it is somehow a kind of amazing experience. It wasn't something I expected. And what I've heard from more and more people who've seen the film is not, I want to tell my friend to go see it. It's, I want to bring my friend and go see it with them. Because there's something deeply emotional about the film that feels like if you can share it with somebody else, that it works in that way. And if, you know, I love the theatrical experience, and, you know, as long as that experience exists for documentaries, like I want that. I mean, and I've done things for streaming services and other people too, but this film just felt special in that way. But also, I feel like a theatrical release helps a dialogue around a film seep into the culture. And the film isn't preachy at all. The film is really full of questions. And we'll know shortly how widely the film translates, but I'm hopeful. You know, so far I've screened it for all kinds of audiences, religious audiences, conservative and liberal audiences. And to me, it supersedes those kinds of labels.
Right. One common thing is the tissues.
Exactly.
Morgan Neville is the director of Won't You Be My Neighbor? Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.